Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mallow, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 130, being recorded on the 8th of June, 2016. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale. So Kale, I'm sure some of our listeners may have noticed that we actually missed a week last week. It doesn't happen often, but just one of those weeks where everyone's schedule was all haywire and everybody was busy, couldn't find the time that all of us were available. So we took a week off. Yay. When was the last time we took a week off? I don't remember when that last happened, but
It's been quite a while.
We've got some catching up to do. We had a bunch of you had put a bunch of notes in the show notes last week, so we should get our listeners caught up with some of them. And there were some good items in there. I saw a couple that you might be ready to jump on. The one on blockchain specifically, and some others. You want to start?
Yeah, sure. Before we get started, we had one for the EDX or edX courses. So I don't know if our listeners are aware, but these are free courses. They're online. It's all self-paced learning. But essentially, we've kind of partnered with edX, and I do some work with them as far as recording videos and talking through different architectures. But the they have a course up there for architecting Azure solutions, primarily for anybody who's, you know, taking the exams, especially the architecture exam. But also, there's a lot of real-world architecture for Azure, different types of applications and services. And so if you're interested in that stuff, check it out. We'll drop a link in the show notes.
That's great. And is this the one where you make an appearance?
Yeah. So we recorded some videos in Redmond, and then we also did some design sessions where we whiteboarded some things. So there's some like interactive whiteboard stuff on there. So
that's great. All right, yeah. Get started on that. Well, you know, the one that I really liked a lot is this MongoDB support that we've added in DocumentDB. You know that DocumentDB is our NoSQL fully managed, you know, automatic partitioning, etc. database that we have. But for a lot of people that maybe are using MongoDB today, they're connecting to the MongoDB using the MongoDB tools and things like that. And for them to be able to switch over to DocumentDB can be quite a task. So we've made like a protocol level kind of translation driver so that you can talk to DocumentDB from a MongoDB toolset, which I think is going to be make it easier for those folks to switch over to DocumentDB. You know, I mean, Azure supports MongoDB as well, but you have to host it yourself, right? You can't. There's no managed MongoDB service in Azure, but we do have this managed DocumentDB service. And so hopefully that'll make it a little easier for those other developers who like MongoDB to try out DocumentDB without investing a whole lot in terms of tools and APIs and things like that.
Cool. Yeah, we had, like you mentioned, Sujit, we had some news about blockchains again. They keep popping up in the news, and there was another big announcement. It was actually right at the end of May there, May 31st. That Microsoft has partnered with Consensus and Blockstack Labs on building an open source identity platform on top of these blockchains powering both Bitcoin and Ethereum. This is kind of an early version. Is going to be out here this summer, but we had a blog post out there from one of our business strategists, and you know, some comments from the guys from Consensus. Talking about this, and really that's around how do we manage identities in this blockchain world, because it's a very different paradigm over there. Things like building reputation systems, and how do we build these things so we can store, maybe even store the identities in blockchain. And it's kind of like a different approach of looking at a blockchain application or a decentralized app when you start looking at potentially, you know, hashing the actual identities.
Nice, yeah. So getting really serious about blockchains, I can see that. It's good to see that. You know, there was an update on the Azure Redis cache, and it's nice to see that they're constantly refining that service. And there were a bunch of updates. We'll put that in the show notes. But two in particular I want to talk about interesting. One is now they have a public preview of import-export of the Azure cache. So typically the Azure cache is, this is kind of held in memory, and then it can be backed up. There's a backing file that you can use, and now you could import and export that backing file so that in case you need to move data from one Azure Redis instance to another, this makes it possible to do that. Another feature that they've added with this new update is called the Azure Redis Cache Advisor. It kind of monitors how you're using the cache and makes suggestions on, what can be done to tweak it to make it a little more responsive. Maybe you need more memory or increase the number of threads or instances and things like that. So those are two, I think, interesting updates in the upcoming, the May 2016 Azure Redis Cache update.
Yeah, along with that, there's a public preview in the premium tier, and one thing that's like huge there that's kind of maybe didn't get noticed, but the use of an Azure Virtual Network with Redis is something that's in public preview with that tier right now. So that's a big deal. I know a lot of people who couldn't leverage Redis in its current form; they would have to host their own through an IaaS instance. So that they could put it in a VNet, because one of the things, if you start working with Redis, especially the service-based one, the PaaS version, is that it just has, like an API key that you use to access it. And a lot of times in the application, they wanted to use, actually, the customers I talked to actually wanted to use NTLM. Hmm. They wanted to use something like that, and they're like, how can we do that and use this? It's just not there. So then they're like, well, then we have these static keys, and they can cycle them, obviously, but they were saying, man, it would really be nice if we could have that in the VNet, and we do have, in public preview that support now. So,
wow, that's excellent. So while not necessarily Azure-specific news, SQL Server 2016 became generally available, and is that available, or are they planning to put that on Azure? I don't. I think they normally do that. They're normally a few, in a few weeks. We expect that to be available, right? In the cloud, they normally have a preview on that available soon. But excuse me. Just something to keep in mind that 2016 is now available, and look for it soon on Azure.
Yeah, and that has. There's a lot of little things in there too, so you should take a look at the blog post or the post that we put in there from the, I think it's from the TechNet side of the house, but they have a really good write-up talking about not just the relational database aspect, but this has the R service stuff built into there. Mm. So it's something to take a look at if you're interested in any of the big data. The Microsoft R services, right, obviously, that we have in Azure, but it's a big deal, and also the R tools in Visual Studio. So if you're into big data or databases in general, it's probably something good to look at.
That's great. And then the Azure SQL Data Warehouse now has a premium storage tier for better performance. So that's something to look for if you're using that particular service. Well, let's jump to the topic of the day. Kale, we've... I think it's fair to say that in the cloud space, Amazon is kind of the leader, right? They were the first of the market, so to speak, and Azure was probably second behind them in terms of maturity and the feature sets that they provide. But the one that kind of, at least I lost track of for a while, and I recently decided to take another look at it, is the Google Cloud Platform. And so I decided to go in and just see how they, what they have and how they matured. And they've done, I must say it's really made some big strides in it, in the platform and the offerings. And so I thought we'll just quickly run through, what they have and how The whole idea is not to do some sort of a, price comparison or whatever. I'm just trying to say, okay, let's, these are the services that they offer, and what services in Azure does it map to, because that'll help our listeners understand. I'm sure listeners are all familiar with some of the Azure services, and if you understand what Google's offering is and map it to an Azure service, then it helps you understand what the Google Cloud Platform is all about. So that's sort of the goal for this particular episode, is to do a quick dive into the Google Cloud Platform and how it maps to Azure. All right.
Sounds good.
Okay. So we'll get started with some of the basics. Of course, they have something called the Google Compute Engine, which is their the place where they go to host virtual machines, and for the most part, that's fairly comparable to our virtual machines. Although I would say it includes virtual machines and the scale sets, because their Google Compute Engine also does the scaling of VMs. So I suppose that you would take those two services in Azure and map it to the Google Compute Engine. For the most part, it offers Linux and Windows. One interesting feature they have is something called preemptive VMs. And what it is these are very cheap virtual machines to run, because they run for at most 24 hours. Okay, it's like a short-lived virtual machine. So say you have a batch job that you have to run, and typically it takes, I don't know, a few hours to run. So you could, this is an ideal thing to, you don't have to have a big commitment in terms of getting a whole VM farm or something like that. You can just rent these short-lived VMs, and they run for at most 24 hours, or if whatever time it actually runs for, and then the VMs just kind of shut down and disappear. And they give you kind of a lower price because it's a very short-lived VM. So I thought that was a an interesting way that they have tackled the whole thing of batch, for batch jobs.
Yeah, I think, this is something that it seems to be trending, which is a good thing, to kind of, with all the containerization and all those different virtualization technologies, it's really great. And everyone knows, I'm sure our listeners know, that on the spectrum, it's like if you sit on the left side of the spectrum, I'll say we have, IaaS, which gives absolute control, right? So you can basically tweak whatever you need to make your workloads run there the best way. And then on the clear right side, we would have something like PaaS, right, where it's fully managed. You basically are really focused, hypersensitive just on your application, and less focused on, like, say, the virtual machine and all that kind of thing. And I don't know. It's always been for me, like, kind of a goal, always when we talk about migrating to the cloud, to get more to that right side, because that's really where the value of something like the cloud offers. And I think Google has some PaaS type services, so does Amazon, and I think people realize that. I don't think that in 10 years we should still be micromanaging, virtual machines. Like, they should, yeah.
I agree. Yes, I'm hoping that everybody moves to PaaS and SaaS solutions soon.
I do think that there'll be some that, there's going to be those workloads where you always have to have that, right?
Yeah,
And
the niche workloads,
yeah, exactly. So I think I heard the analogy that's really funny. It's basically like the comparison between a pet and potentially something like cattle. So where, like, if you look at your cloud that way, your pet has a name, you're very intimate, and you know that thing very well, and all this kind of thing, and it requires a lot of attention, where cattle are more like, it's a number kind of thing. So you manage them in a different way, but it's a good way, to manage something where, you're managing from a higher level kind of
That's
thing.
true. Good analogy. Yeah, I like that. So moving on to the Google App Engine, which is, as you just mentioned, their PaaS platform. It's used to build scalable applications, web applications, mobile applications, IoT backends, etc. It's a Linux-based system, and I think you get like a You can use PHP and Python and one of those kind of languages to build. It's very asynchronous in nature, but it does come. It comes packaged in with things like a NoSQL data store, and I'll talk about that in just a minute when we get to storage. It has Memcache and a user authentication API, and you know, it's the kind of things that are common to most applications. So. When I was trying to map that to ours, obviously that's our cloud services, right, that we have, or possibly even our web apps, which is our Neopaz kind of system. Also, since we talk about authentication, user authentication, I guess some of the B2C stuff might fall in here, the Azure B2C. And what else? So let's talk about the NoSQL data store. I might as well do that now because that's something that's important. So we've got Azure storage is made up of blob storage, table storage, and queue storage. And for the most part, when they talk about the kind of the NoSQL that they're talking about is the table storage, all right? And that basically it's their big table. They call it the Google Big Table service or Cloud Big Table. It's essentially you can have a couple of simple keys on it for indexing, and the rest of it is up to you to manage, so to speak. So that kind of what they do is they package that with the PaaS offering, which is kind of interesting. We don't do that. I think for us, you kind of have to get your cloud servers, and then you have to map it to, I guess, a table, an Azure table, and kind of tie in a bunch of different services. They kind of bundle it all together, which I thought is an interesting way of doing it too. I suppose it's a little easier to get started that way.
Yeah, we had a past talk, one of our episodes, we talked about some of the interoperability and some of these abstraction frameworks that were kind of evolving, like libcloud and some of these package cloud that basically is, and storage is a big one, right? So when you start talking about NoSQL or blob storage, that one's like kind of a no-brainer. Like it works relatively easy with those kind of things as opposed to something like a virtual machine, because there's a lot of nuances between those things. But yeah, I think that's really cool in that area that we can be able to interoperate and have build abstraction layers there to allow people to potentially, if they need to, leverage multiple clouds during a migration or actually in steady state. I think there's a lot of similarities between the platforms on a storage level.
Absolutely, yeah, it's pretty much a very very close mapping. I forgot to mention, I did say that they come with the Google App Engine comes with the Memcache support, and I suppose on our side that would be something like a Redis cache, although it's not completely the same because Memcache does require you to have a VM that has memory in it, so you kind of bring your own memory, so to speak, whereas with the Azure with the Redis cache service, you're paying for the memory in the Redis cache system itself. But that's for the app engine. Then moving on to the Google Container Engine, I guess no surprise there, that directly maps to our ACS or Azure Container Service, and it's pretty much one-to-one mapping there. Ours is based primarily on Mesosphere and Swarm. They use Kubernetes primarily, so I guess that's a slight difference over there. They also, you want to say something, Kale?
Yeah. The on the container front, I've been reading some stuff about some new things, and maybe we should do a show about this at some point, with some of the new technology around even beyond containers. So it was like, we started with this virtualization at the hardware level so that we could run, these operating system guest OS. But then the containers came along to kind of say, okay, could we pull out like the operating system stuff and you just focus on the individual components that make up your container, mm-hmm. So you can run your application best, which is awesome. Like it's just like another level of virtualization, and that's what Google and Amazon and Microsoft all are in that, using these different tools like you mentioned. Yeah. But beyond that, then there's some new technology that's surfacing now. These things called unikernels. This is not something like brand new, like that just came out. It's something I think that's been being worked on for quite some time. And really, what those are around is actually stripping it down to the lowest level and saying, like, I only need this individual component to make this app work, as opposed to even a container. So you can essentially run this on top of a virtualization level, but it is a very self-contained, very small thing. So you can think of, like, if it was just like a DNS server or something of that nature, you could actually just have that feature be there. And actually, some of the extreme stuff I've been reading about was saying, like, you could actually surface it just on individual requests, if you can imagine that. So these things are that small that you could say, hey, a TCP request comes in to do something with the server. It gets literally started for that request and killed immediately afterwards, almost like a process. Yeah.
Wow. So this is almost like taking something like a nano server, which is very stripped down, and making like a container out of it.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that seems to be the trend to continue this trek towards, you know, just the absolute minimum that you need to run those applications as light as possible, so that, you know, you don't have to think about, like, the failure stuff as much like we do now, the HA things.
Yeah.
When every request is hitting something new, there's less worry about, like, oh, we have to maintain state and all these kind of weird things like we do today with persistent VMs and those kind of things.
Yep. That's a good point. Now, one of the things that they have offered is a private Docker container image repository. I don't recall, but do we have one in the ACS? Does that come with a repository as well? It's just,
No.
There's a public repository, but there isn't a private one, is it?
That's correct. I mean, ours are all fed out of, if people choose to do it, they can, you know, have them in the public Docker hub, I think it's called. Which is like GitHub, but they're public exposed. We don't host a private one in our platform.
Got it. So the next thing that they have, which was a direct one-to-one mapping, is something called Cloud Functions. And as you know, ours is also called Azure Functions. We had an episode on it just a couple of weeks ago, I think. And that's also based on Node.js, just like ours. So that's a fairly simple one to map out. Okay, moving on to some of the storage. I did briefly talk about storage earlier, but essentially, their blob storage is, you know, I guess that's the main part of their storage system is the blob storage. And what's interesting is that they have three different varieties of it. Okay, one is the standard, which is how we would call blob storage. You know, it's fast, always available, very low latency, etc. But they also have something called DRA. Okay. Which is durable storage. So durable storage is extremely durable in the sense that, you know, it's not going to go away, but the availability is slightly less, okay? So instead of 3 nines, it's 2 nines, you know? And then they have something called nearline storage, which is, again, very durable, but the latency might be a little, may not be good enough for, say, a real-time application. So it's good for backups and things like that, you know? So they have kind of storage in three different flavors, so to speak, depending on what your needs are. And from our perspective, the standard storage maps to our blob storage. And of course, we have something called Azure Backup, which can map to the nearline storage, for example. And you know, the price points are different for each of them, so that kind of maps up. Then I talked about the Cloud Bigtable earlier, which maps to our Azure tables, so we'll skip over that. The next one that comes on the list is the Google Cloud Data Store, and this is their highly scalable NoSQL database that has the automatic sharding, replication, etc. As you can tell, that maps to our DocumentDB service. Seems fairly, identical in the same level in terms of feature sets and things like that.
I think the caution there, the only thing I see is, like we mentioned in the news, the MongoDB, how, you know, basically we have a an interface there now, so that if you do have an app running in MongoDB, it's very easy to bring it over, and the backend's actually running on DocDB with this interface to allow it to operate under the same kind of commands, I guess, if you will, with Mongo. But I think the other ones, they kind of diverge, right? Like DocumentDB has its own kind of implementation that we've kind of perfected, and Google has something as well. So
yep.
The one caution there is if somebody is doing a migration, I don't know that there'll be a simple way to bring that over because of the way the platforms have been developed.
Yeah, that's going to be tough. They seem kind of on the same level in terms of feature sets, but I'm sure there's differences in the APIs.
Yeah.
Coming on next is the Google Cloud SQL. So they use MySQL. It's a fully managed MySQL database. Kind of has all the bells and whistles as you would expect, and that kind of maps to our Azure SQL service pretty much. Then moving on to networking. Okay, networking, their first offering that they have is the Google Cloud Virtual Network. No surprise, that maps to our virtual network offering. They also have things like the virtual private cloud and being able to connect into VPNs. So that maps to our VPN gateway service that we have, allowing you to set up, connect from the on-premises over to the Google Cloud. Then their next service is their load balancer, the Google Cloud Load Balancer. This has an interesting feature. I mean, this, of course, maps to our Traffic Manager and our Load Balancer service for the most part. But they have kind of paraphrased this very interestingly. They said, you can put your resources behind a single Anycast IP. You know, I had never heard about Anycast IP until I read about this. I looked it up, and it's interesting. I guess that's one way to describe a load balancer is an Anycast IP, which is your traffic gets sent to the nearest recipient. You know, it's a way of broadcast sending it to IP addresses, but sending it to just one of the nearest recipients out there. So that's how they call it, Anycast IP.
I think that's something, too, that in Azure's been evolving. I don't know, we talked that much about that in the past, but that service, I don't know, it feels like it doesn't get enough press, but the load balancing stuff, because we do internal and external now, and as well as you mentioned, Traffic Manager, but there, it's pretty detailed. If you start reading about our load balancing, we do a 5-tuple algorithm to do the load balancing, and there's a lot of customization there, so... I don't know if we could have a show about it, but it's something that you should look at in terms of capabilities if you're looking for those types of functions.
It sounds like a good topic for a show. So moving on to the Google Cloud DNS, I suppose this maps directly to our Azure DNS. Not much to talk about over there.
Do you know for sure if that? And so is that a public DNS like? Like a DNS register, like a GoDaddy or something like that, or is it something for internal? Because I think that would be the key kind of distinction there.
No, it says it's their public DNS. They use it for Google.com, for example.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
So then, again, on the networking area, they have something called the Google Cloud Interconnect, which allows cloud platform customers to connect to Google via the enterprise-grade connections, you know, for high availability, low latency. Of course, that's our Express Route service. Fairly similar, I thought. Wasn't really clear to me whether that hooked up to the virtual networks, but I'm sure it does. Then moving on to the Google Cloud CDN, that again maps to our CDN service. They also use the global load balancer, so our traffic manager, I guess, may be another feature that adds into the CDN in our case.
That seems like a kind of a clear distinction. I don't know the details about Google's. Maybe you do, Sajid. The what we've chosen to do there is kind of partner with some of the leaders in that industry. Like just recently, we announced the premium version, which is actually backed by Akamai. So I think that I don't know if they're partnered with people or if they're building that themselves, but it seems like there might be a slight difference between our platforms.
You may be right there. They don't, I don't think they're, it doesn't look like they're partnering with anybody. It's something that they've built. They're basically whatever they use to run Google.com and all the Google services, they made that available. So yeah, it's a good distinction though. Here we have that premium service through Akamai. Then moving on to big data, which is sort of the next category, real quick. The first obvious one is something called Google BigQuery, and this is their data warehouse platform. So it kind of maps to a SQL data warehouse in a way. It's not like a SQL data warehouse is actually based on a SQL engine. I think they have their own engine. They're not using MySQL or anything like that, so it's something that they built internally, but essentially does the same thing. It's basically low cost analytics for data, and no infrastructure. You just provision what you need and pay as you go. Uses just standard SQL commands to pull your queries out. Next up is something called the Google Cloud Dataflow. And this offers like a unified programming model and managed service to do data processing patterns, including streaming, analytics, ETL, batch processing, etc. And this kind of maps to our a batch stream insight and data factory.
Yeah, I was thinking Data Factory when you mentioned it there, Sajid, that these types of tools to do, I don't know if they're full-blown ETL tools, but something similar to that function where you can essentially map and move data between various sources and maybe do some small transformation.
Thanks, Gail. All right, so the next up was the Google Cloud Dataproc, and this is their managed Spark and Hadoop service. Of course, that maps directly to our HD Insight service. No surprises there. And Google was the one who kind of, I suppose, invented Hadoop and whatnot. So they do. Okay, I'm sure, pretty sure they're good at that. The next one up is the Google Cloud Data Lab, which is their it's an interactive notebook based on Jupyter to explore, collaborate, and analyze and visualize data. It's integrated with their BigQuery and their cloud machine learning. I kind of saw this as Power BI, as a as a kind of mapping. Anything else come to mind?
Yeah, it feels like a data insights tool. I don't know it as well, but again, feels like something where you're trying to do some type of analytics or even like light reporting kind of thing on top of whatever you're looking at there.
Yep. Okay, great. Then the next one is the Google Cloud PubSub, and this is the standard PubSub. I'm thinking it's like Event Hub or even the Service Bus.
Yeah, I think we have a pretty good offering there too with the different flavors of Service Bus, as well as, like you said, Event Hub, and some of the pieces that plug into that notification hubs and things.
Right. Next up is their machine learning platform. Again, this is again, I would kind of map this a little bit to ML, our machine learning platform itself. Wasn't clear to me whether they use R or not. I didn't look into that detail, but from the surface, it looks like it's comparable. Then they have something called the Google Cloud Vision API, and we have the cognitive service that we offer, but it's not really an actual service, but I think we do have that extra service that is available, so that could be a compatible mapping. Same.
Yeah, and also we have the I think that kind of workload where you're doing kind of deep learning type algorithms, a combination of machine learning, and like you said, we have a whole suite of tools with the cognitive services with both vision, like image-based stuff, and other types, like text-to-speech and all those kind of different flavors of that stuff. The PaaS stuff's really nice with that, with the, when you can access it through an API, which I assume is what the vision stuff is about. And then when you get beyond that, it's just the typical PaaS IaaS thing. Like you can stand up the IaaS VMs in ours with, we have announced the preview, at the N series, that's going to be coming out with the GPUs and those
Right,
kind of
right,
things,
right.
which function best for that, yeah.
And then similar to that, they have a cloud speech API and a translate API, and we have offerings, the cognitive offerings, the Cortana services that we offer, and we have a translation API as well. So So it's kind of comparison. Just moving on to then monitoring, and they have something called Stackdriver, which is something they talk about a lot. And Stackdriver is their, I think it's like a, it's something that's built into all their services that provides monitoring, logging, and diagnostics. I kind of would compare that to our App Insight or and our Operational Insight together, because we have all that bundled in there. But they have, they provide things like real-time log management, real-time exception monitoring and alerting, performance insights, analytics, performance analytics, etc. And so for me, all of that looks like what we offer through App Insights and Operation Insights.
Yeah, and the other one to add to that is it's another Insights, but Azure Insights. So we have App Insights, Op Insights, and Azure Insights. Azure Insights is what formerly was known as that's the API to access like audit logs and the operational logs they used to be called in Azure. So same deal, right? At the control plane level or like inside Azure, like the stuff that's managed by Azure kind of thing, you can get the input from that. So any kind of CRUD operation that you're doing to the API into Azure, obviously is going to be logged there, and you can get that stuff through the Insights API, which has been like growing like crazy. I think we announced in one of our news things just recently that they now have support not just to we did before where we basically would manage it for users, so you didn't have to pay for the storage. It was there, right? You just got it for free. And then people started saying, well, yeah, but you have limitations around it, saying how long we can keep those and those kind of things, which, you could arguably just copy it out to a storage account and keep it and use that. But, there's work involved there. So then we took the step to say, well, we'll go ahead and allow it for some services, and it's still growing in preview to be able to put that stuff out into a customer storage account. So you can create your own storage account and have it dump there and keep as many as you want forever or however long you want. And then we took it a step further, which is in preview, which is to hook it up to the Event Hub so that now you could get real time. So if you wanted to build a platform or hook up your management system directly into a feed, essentially coming out of Azure, you can do the same. And the data plane is following a similar course, and data plane being the individual services.
That's amazing. Yeah. So there's ways you can tie it all together to do bigger and better things here. So they have something called the Google Cloud Deployment Manager, and the way they explain it is pretty interesting because it says that it allows you to specify all the resources needed for your application in a declarative format using YAML. And that sounds like our ARM template, right? A lot. So it looked like they have a similar concept where you could just define everything in this one JSON file and then kind of upload it.
Yeah, it's used a lot in Node too. I don't think the YAML, at least I'm not sure, I don't think that it's any different than the YAML that's used for like Node applications, which is like if you've spun a Node app up, like your config files or your the JSON that's describing your stuff, like you said, Sujeet, kind of like similar to ARM, right? That's where you'd put those key value pairs kind of things.
And then they have the powerful Web Admin UI, which is kind of our Azure portal. They have a cloud command line, which is we have the Azure command line, which is based on Node. They do have a mobile app, which was I thought was interesting. We don't have an official mobile app, correct?
Hey, I think there's some that people put out there. I don't know if they're officially from Microsoft. Yeah, I don't know that there's an official one.
That's the one thing I thought they have. Do they have a an Android-based application and iOS as well? They have a billing API, which we also have. And then for development purposes, of course, they've got a lot of cool things. They have their own Git kind of instance, so that's our VS DS Online. They allow you to create the API backend, so they've got that like how we have API apps and API management, features. So they have something similar. They call them the Google Cloud Endpoints is what they call it. And then they have something specifically for Android, which we obviously don't have. On the security side, they have the Google Cloud Identity and Access Management. And that kind of maps to our AD B2C offering and possibly a little bit of our MFA offering, the multi-factor authentication.
Yeah, and I think some of that stuff too, the mobile stuff will come. I think one of the things that's driving that now, at least from my side, what I'm thinking, and we've been starting to experiment with, was using the bot framework in some of that stuff that we have, just kind of having public preview out there. But it brings up interesting opportunities to be able to create a bot that could basically act on your behalf to do things. Potentially even like in your Azure account, right? So if you wanted to influence things in your system, like shut down VMs or cause certain things to happen, obviously you can write an app to do that yourself, but the bot framework kind of enables that in an easier way.
Yep. You know, on the development side, one of the things, the cool things that they have, which I don't think we have in ours, is they have a debugger that lets you investigate your code's behavior in production. You can actually step into the code in production, which is kind of, I don't know how it actually works. I gotta take a look at it, but that seems like an interesting thing to do.
I mean, we do the same, right? So like, you could take it the whole way from the IaaS level up to the web app, right? With Kudu, that's what those hooks are in there for, to allow us to have remote debuggers running. If you choose, you can enable those, and then you can basically step through it. Like if you're in Visual Studio, you can set a breakpoint and literally stop your production site, which probably not good for production, but maybe for like a development.
That's right. I forgot about Kudu. You're right. Glad you reminded me about that. That's great. Okay, then just to round up a couple of things over here. Let's see. They have something called an automated vulnerability scanning, and so that's our security center, is what I mapped it to. It says it's a web security scanner for common vulnerabilities in the Google App Engine applications. Can actually scan for and detect, various kind of cross-scripting issues, flash injection, mixed
I
content,
think,
etc.
I think you're right. Like, I think the security center maybe is becoming that, but also we had, I think Bernardo was his name, a while back, talking about resource health, which was kind of another thing around that, like to help you diagnose or even proactively change things in your environment to make it more robust or secure.
You're right. Forgot about that. Excellent. So that's basically the breadth of their service. There's a lot of things that they don't have, right? I covered up things that they map to, but there's a whole list of things that they don't really have. They don't have things specific to IoT, the IoT suite. They don't have things for like a data lake, a search, mobile engagement, notification hubs, service fabric, the Key Vault, scheduler, automation. They don't have a queue, a basic Azure queue, like a cloud queue. I didn't see that. Obviously, you don't have BizTalk server or StorSimple and media services. So some of those, some things that they didn't really have. But they've come a long way. I'm quite impressed.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of parity between the systems. Like you mentioned here, you can probably see like a lot of the services map up really closely. They might not be exact, but they're pretty close. But it makes it interesting for people who are doing migrations or, like you said, running them in parallel.
Yep. Well, Kale, I think that's it then. That was a good discussion. Thank you for providing all the I noticed you kind of were protecting Azure quite a bit during that discussion.
No, 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 no protection. No protection. I just want to make sure that people know what we have, that's all.
That's good. That was good that you did that. But thanks, and you enjoy the rest of your stay out on the West Coast there. All right.
Thanks, guys.
Take care. Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.